Roosevelt, tell him about Mark Twain. Mark Twain, well, Mark Twain, everybody learns about as the author of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. But when we go to school, we don't learn about Mark Twain as the vice president of the Anti-Imperialist League. We aren't told that Mark Twain denounced Theodore Roosevelt for approving this massacre of the Philippines. You know, we want to give young people ideal figures like Helen Keller. And I remember learning about Helen Keller. Everybody learns about Helen Keller. You know, a disabled person who overcame her handicaps and became famous. But people don't learn in school, and young people don't learn in school what we want them to learn when we do books like A Young People's History of the United States, that Helen Keller was a socialist. She was a labor organizer. She refused to cross a picket line that was picketing a theater showing a play about her. And so there are these alternate heroes in American history. There's Fannie Lou Hamer and Bob Moses. They're the heroes of the civil rights movement. There are a lot of people who are obscure, who are not known. We have in this young people's history, we have a young hero who was sitting on the bus and in Montgomery, Alabama, refused to leave the front of the bus. And it was before Rosa Parks. I mean, Rosa Parks is justifiably famous for refusing to leave her seat, and she got arrested, and that was the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott and really the beginning of a great movement in the South. But we, this 15-year-old girl did it first. And so we have a lot of, we are trying to bring a lot of these obscure people back into the forefront of our attention and inspire young people to say, this is the way to live.
Howard Zinn in the Democracy Now! Studio in 2009. Tune in Labor Day for an expanded Zinntennial, our tribute to Howard Zinn to mark what would have been his 100th birthday. We'll include dramatic readings from voices of a people's history, including Alfre Woodard reading the words of the labor activist Mother Jones. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Neil Shabata, and Brendan Allen. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 8:01. It's time for Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
You're slick, you investors in hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you're a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done. War after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting-edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket.
Yes, again. Yes, again, that's Buffy St. Marie with our de facto theme song. I'll be changing now and then when I change themes, but... I am continuing on the theme of the military and climate change and broader issues involving technology and climate change, which we're going to be talking about with my guest this morning, Alejandro de la Garza of Time Magazine, who I will introduce in just a second. I did want to thank a listener, Barry Klein. I hope he doesn't mind. Oh, all the way from Houston, Texas. Wow. People listening from all over the place, apparently. Well, anyway, He sent me an interesting brochure, Wars Without End? Americans on the Left and Right Are Uniting to Ask Why, a call to reform U.S. foreign policy, with an interesting list of endorsers. So that's an interesting initiative I hadn't heard of. And I just wanted to kind of also use that to say that you too can send me information by snail mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Of course, I do have an email which you can get to through my program page at Wednesday Talk Radio at kboo.fm. Just follow the green, whatever that's called, highlighted links, and you'll get to me. I did have a Gmail address dedicated, but I haven't used that in a while. Maybe I'll start using that again if there's a popular clamor. Okay, so we are again, the last time for a little while. Actually, no, next week we'll be talking with Zoltan Grossman of Evergreen State College about the regional aspect of what I've been talking about for the past several weeks. The military's role in climate change, and a deep historical look here in mostly the Puget Sound areas. So that should be really worth listening to next week. Okay, here we are today, and the headline that caught my attention was, to take climate change seriously, the U.S. military needs to shrink. That was in Time magazine when I was doing a furious Google search of articles on the subject, and that one struck me as really pertinent and incisive. And so I took a look, and he's Alejandro de la Garza, the Time journalist, has written quite a bit widely about the subject of technology and climate change. So I welcome you to KBOO this morning, Alejandro.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm really glad to have you. So as I do with all my guests generally, is I'd like to just hear you kind of introduce yourself, how you got into journalism and Time magazine, and your specialization on technology and climate change.
Sure. So I started at Time magazine, I guess, about 4 years ago. I was a reporter, researcher, and doing a lot of fact-checking. And at the same time, I was starting to build up a reporting beat on technology. And at the time, that was more sort of computer technology, like internet technology for technology's sake, you know. But it turns out that's more of a strict business reporting type of beat. So over the course of the next couple of years, I sort of slowly transitioned to healthcare reporting, and then about a year and a half ago, started reporting full-time on energy and climate. So we kind of consider it a sort of intersection of technology and climate here. But in practice, that ends up being mostly focused on energy, chemical industry, gas, carbon capture, and all the interesting ways that various industries are trying to tell us to address climate change. So that's my specialty.
So was that kind of a crash course? I mean, had you been tuned in to those issues before?
Yeah, well, there's sort of a pretty significant dearth of coverage in the U.S. on energy and climate change. I mean, so yeah, it's a bit of a crash course over the course of the past year and a half, but all this stuff is so new. A lot of the carbon capture infrastructure, a lot of the initiatives that, you know, companies, from shipping companies, you know, to the military, are putting out, that, you know, it's not clear really if anyone is an expert. So when you start taking a deep look and really trying to talk to as many folks as possible, you start finding yourself knowing a lot more than a lot of other people in the room very quickly. But of course, there's a lot of people who've been working in this field for years who know a lot more than me. So I don't pretend to be the end-all be-all expert on any of these things, but I try to collect a diverse array of perspectives from multiple angles. I kind of see that as my job.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's an incredibly valuable job, and I, you got my attention. I'm sure you've got a lot of people's attention. And now you're here on our little humble little radio station, getting a few more ears to what you're what you've been into. So yeah, I for one appreciate it, because as I said, I was looking for articles on that particular subject. But you know, I've been covering the issue of climate change from a lot of different angles, including a number of the ones that you've been tackling. And it's always refreshing to get someone who just sort of, you know, takes the bull by the horns, as it were, and just gets right into it with some pretty straightforward investigative reporting on what's going on. So with that in mind, I had asked you before, we talked shortly before the show, to, I don't know, just give people a little sense of your writing and how you approach things, and maybe read a few of the first paragraphs of that. To take climate change seriously, the U.S. military needs to shrink article, which came out, was it in February, I think? Yeah, February 17 of this year. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. All right. I'm going to clear my throat here. In November 2020, a flatbed truck pulled onto the Sterling Heights, Michigan campus of military contractor BAE Systems and unloaded two huge lozenge-shaped Bradley vehicles, a special delivery from the U.S. Army. Workers moved the vehicles into a garage and began pulling them apart, swapping in smaller gasoline engines, electric motors, and a new lithium-ion battery. The exact battery capabilities are a military secret. The result, a hybrid electric troop transport, is best likened to a 28-ton Prius, plus tank treads, a turret, and a 25-millimeter cannon, all with an expected 10 to 20% improvement in fuel economy. The Army is getting greater capability, dependability, and survivability with the hybrid electric drive, says Jim Miller, head of business development at BAE's Combat Systems Division, and then they get the environmental impact. To be clear, even a hybrid electric Bradley is about as friendly to the environment as it is to anybody on the wrong end of its Bushmaster chain gun. The electric upgrade could push fuel economy close to 0.9 miles per gallon from 0.75 before, but the improvement could amount to substantial fuel savings and accompanying emissions reductions across all U.S. forces, especially if BAE is able to apply its hybrid technology to other armored vehicles, as the company hopes. Military vehicles, along with the forces that use them and the industries that supply them, represent a huge climate problem, accounting for 5% of the world's carbon emissions every year. And there's no bigger actor in that space than the U.S. military, which sucks up more petroleum than any other institution on Earth to fly jets, heat buildings, and ferry food and supplies to 750 bases spread across the world, a process that, all told, produces an emissions footprint greater than the entire country of Sweden.
Well, thank you for that. I think it's nice occasionally just to kind of get into some of the nuts and bolts of what some, I guess, writers like you get into. And, you know, when you talk to some of these, you know, specifically the military contractors who are dealing with this, you know, they, broadly speaking, the greening of the military, which, you know, if one Googles military and climate change, that's one of the major themes. That's a big class of articles on that topic are about, you know, these efforts now to do exactly what you were just reading about. But you get into it a little deeper. You know, you say that might be changing, though. The Department of Defense has embarked on a decarbonization push. So yeah, maybe just start off with that, get a little deeper into what some of those efforts have been, you know, before we get into some critique of it and your, you know, the thesis of the article that, you know, all those things might not add up to really much in the end. And the main problem is the actual size of not just the U.S. military, but militaries across the globe. So what are the militaries? When did this start? And what are they doing to supposedly go green?
Yeah, sure. So it's a great question and a really pretty fascinating area. So surprisingly, I mean, the military is, you know, as most people are probably aware, is you know, a pretty conservative institution in a lot of different senses, and tends to move, you know, maybe a step back from society at large in a lot of you know, social and economic, like social issues over the decades. But in the issue of climate change, they're somewhat ahead of the curve in at least one respect, which is acknowledging that it's real. So back in 2003, you know, the Bush administration was still talking about, you know, maybe climate change is real, maybe it's not, but we're not going to do anything. regardless. But the U.S. military was hiring experts and drafting reports to look at the impacts of climate change on military bases and how it was going to affect, you know, the strategic landscape that the U.S. was going to be dealing with in the next 20 years. And that's because for all its faults and all its, you know, particular myopias, the U.S. military is interested in doing its job and interested in doing that job in the real world and not in a fantasy world. So they took climate change from a strategic perspective very seriously, and they've been taking it seriously from a strategic perspective for a number.
Uh-oh, that's not good. Well, I think my board operator is going to have to call the our guest Alejandro de la Garza again, but that shouldn't take too long. No worries, folks. Something must have happened with his headset or something, but he'll be back shortly. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. One of the voices of the community, a powerful grassroots voice, has been around for 53 years, supported by you, the listeners. If you are not a member, if you would like to support the station in a financial sense, you can go to kboo.fm. There's a donate button there. We really appreciate your support. And we got Alejandro back. I don't know what happened, but hopefully we can avoid that in the future. So you were in the middle of a sentence.
Yeah. let me see if I can get back my train of thought. But yeah, that was weird. So the military has been taking climate change pretty seriously from a strategic perspective in you know, basically looking at what kind of threats it's going to be facing around the world. And, you know, as you might imagine, that's, you know, rising sea levels that impact military bases, increased refugees, which, you know, you can talk, get into the whole topic of the securitization of climate change and how, you know, we start viewing refugees as threats rather than victims.
Well, let me just as a parenthesis to just to clarify. So the one big class of articles that you find when you look at this issue is the greening of the military. The other maybe bigger class is how militaries view climate, mostly through the lens of a global threat and national security issue.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think that's sort of like the you know, the first class of articles or the first class of, like, the primary category of conversation, which I guess arises from that initial focus of the U.S. military and other militaries, is, you know, militaries are taking climate change seriously. Look at how they're taking it seriously. They're trying to adapt to the threat of climate change. And so that kind of, you know, it's helpful in a certain sense because, you know, these are articles targeted at the conversation you know, of a few years ago, where you still have, you know, people, supposedly credible people, who are saying climate change isn't real, or, you know, trying to, you know, say that we don't have to do anything to climate change, and see, you know, the counters to that is, you know, look at the military, they're doing stuff in anticipation of climate change, they're taking this seriously. But, you know, it has nothing to do with the idea of addressing or mitigating climate change, as they say, you know, stopping it from happening. It's merely an acknowledgement that it's real, and it's an acknowledgement that it's real through the perspective of militaries, which, you know, has some significant downsides when it comes to, you know, the collective good. Militaries are focused on are a particular tool to benefit particular national interests in a particular way. So anyway, I think I'm getting a little afield here, but the point is that the military has been interested in this for a while. So what's changed in the past few years, though, is that and in the past few months, I guess, in some cases it's been pretty quick. I mean, basically since the Biden administration came in, is that the military has started actually looking at technologies that would reduce emissions. So not merely considering the geostrategic impact of climate change and how that, you know, is going to impact what kinds of threats they're going to face, but also starting to look at technologies that would actually reduce emissions. So that those kinds of things are, you know, that hybrid electric Bradley fighting vehicle, which I thought was such a striking example. You know, putting a hybrid motor in a tank, basically. I mean, it's a troop transport, but it's a heavy armored fighting vehicle with a big gun on it. But then you also have GM and other players are competing to supply electric troop vehicles to the military. So, you know, basically electrified Hummers. The military is looking at, or the Army is going to try to electrify all non-combat vehicles by 2035, and then all combat vehicles by 2050. There's electric drives in the Navy, and then there's you know, the potential for more efficient engines that the Air Force is looking at, and you know, so-called renewable aviation fuels or sustainable aviation fuels, which is basically when you are able to make something akin to kerosene from building blocks, chemical building blocks that you don't pull out of the ground. So you can actually take carbon dioxide from the air and then input a ton of energy. That energy, you know, in order to be sustainable, has to come from renewable sources, and then you can turn it into fuel and then fly jets with it. So those are all things that have started happening in the past few years, and recently, under the Biden administration, you've had a really radical shift in the way that defense leaders are talking about climate change, because for the first time ever, they're actually saying we are going to reduce our emissions footprint. So that's the big change in recent years. And before that, you know, the military, whenever it talked about climate change, never mentioned that there was anything they were going to do with regards to their own emissions. And as I guess we got into in the beginning of that article there, the U.S. military's emissions are, you know, a pretty significant piece of a pretty significant pie, which is militaries around the world, and the U.S. military being the largest one far and away. So I'm going to pause there.
Yeah, no, and of course, as I understand it, the military so-called carbon footprint, the emissions, fossil fuel use and subsequent emissions coming out of the world's militaries are basically exempted from the UN framework on climate change. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. I I don't know how far we were going to those negotiations were going to get if they didn't exempt them. They also exempted international aviation and international shipping. But yeah, those are big ticket items that are sort of left out. So mm-hmm. No one's forcing nations to cut their carbon footprint at this point. I mean, you know, the international agreements aren't forcing them either, really. But the military, no one's even, you know, talked about decarbonizing militaries on a global scale. That's just kind of a big.
We're still caught in massive geopolitical tension, conflict, and war, which seems to be a continually leading us in the opposite direction. But anyway, that's my editorializing, and I don't expect you to do much editorializing unless you want to. But anyway, you do write here, still the Biden administration has avoided imposing hard limits on Department of Defense emissions. In a December executive order, that's less than a year ago, President Biden pledged to cut the federal government's carbon footprint to zero. Good luck with that, by 2050, but exempted anything related to national security. There you go. So he talks one talk, but did something different there, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think the next sentence there is pretty important too. So the military accounts for about 77 to 80% of federal energy use over the past two decades. So if you're talking about, you know, decarbonizing the federal government, you know, it's all well and good to start, you know, buying, you know, energy efficient light bulbs and using wind and solar to power the Health and Human Services building in Washington. But, you know, most of what the U.S. government does that actually uses energy and causes emissions is, you know, maintaining the U.S. military at home and abroad, and especially flying a whole lot of planes that use a tremendous amount of fuel. But we can get into that later.
Indeed. And once again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular weekly host, and I have a guest this morning from Time Magazine is is Alejandro de la Garza, who's been there for 4 years. I guess a staff writer for about a year and a half or so. Is that right?
Staff writer for about 6 months.
Oh, 6 months. Okay. Well, you were writing articles, and then you got, I guess, staff writer is a formal position. Okay, great. Well, congratulations on that. And kudos to Time Magazine for seeing the value of your reporting. And needs to be more out there like that. So we're talking about the military and climate change, as I have been for several weeks. Specifically the U.S. military, but my take is that, you know, somehow we need to, well, I'll just put this out there. I tend to editorialize as a host here for a fair amount, but it seems like we talked about the Conference of the Parties, the U.N. framework, leaving out huge swaths of contributors to climate change, greenhouse gases. And they basically have come up with very weak and mostly non-binding ways of getting people to reduce, which doesn't seem to be doing much good. And they don't require the participation of high-level ministerial. You know, you'll get some presidents going there for half a day or a day, you know, making their appearance, or a vice president, or maybe a cabinet secretary. But it's not really at the highest levels of government. Whereas, you know, if we're talking about, you know, actually coming to global agreements on reductions in military emissions, you really would have to do that. And you would have to really get into a lot of the nitty-gritty geopolitical conflicts, which they don't seem to want to deal with. But anyway, that's a sort of a broad framework, how I'm looking at this question. As a reporter, you've been, as I say, dealing with a lot of different aspects of technology and climate change. You'll sort of just steer briefly away from the military. You wrote about a couple articles recent about the infrastructure bill. And of course, you know, why is the military left out of infrastructure? Military infrastructure is a huge part. There's so many military bases, you know, transport routes, et cetera. It's airports, ports. It's a massive part of our infrastructure. But there seems to be this strange sort of schizoid separation. Talk about how you saw this infrastructure bill and maybe some of its just give me sort of your take on the infrastructure bill, maybe what it left out, what are the things that you saw that were actually addressing some of the issues that you've been dealing with.
Sure. I mean, the infrastructure bill, I hadn't actually thought too much about how that, the interplay between that and the military, though. You know, the military has all the money it needs to do whatever it wants. So they're pursuing, I mean, what decarbonization initiatives they are pursuing. I mean, it's basically what they choose to buy, like what they decide to procure, and what they're going to build for the next decades ahead in terms of fuel infrastructure and stuff. So the Inflation Reduction Act, the new climate bill, I think focuses, you know, that's sort of like the purview of the executive, President Biden, to tell the military how to spend that money. And, you know, I guess that would be in the defense authorization bill as well. Most of the stuff in the IRA is, I guess, focused, with regards to climate, to basically steering the economy towards, a lower, carbon version of itself, encouraging the, you know, proliferation of electric vehicles, massive build out of renewables, wind and solar, and then the contingent that I've focused on mostly and sort of my pet issue, which is carbon capture. So the Inflation Reduction Act massively incentivizes the build out of carbon capture infrastructure.
Explain that a little bit for people who may not be so familiar.
Sure. Yeah, so it's a bit wonky, but there's easy ways to think about it. Basically there's two kinds of carbon capture infrastructure. There's direct air carbon capture, so that's people who want to use energy to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So you instead, you kind of are supposed to be able to run the climate clock backwards and reduce the total CO2 concentration in the atmosphere by building gigantic machines that will suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. And you need to caveat that and say that with current technology, there's very little chance that it's not as if you could run a coal plant and then undo that coal plant's emissions. I mean, we're talking about gigantic differences in scale here. But there's some indication and indication from the international climate scientist community that we will have to basically, we're so far gone with regard to emissions that we're going to have to figure out a way for to actually undo some of our emissions even after we get to net zero. So the argument is that, yes, these projects are tiny, insignificant, specks on the, CO2 calculus of the world. And, maybe the energy, and money would be better used to build a solar plant than build a carbon sucking machine. But in the long term, we have to build out that infrastructure and figure out a way to get it into the gigaton range in order to have any hope of stabilizing the Earth's climate. So that's one kind of carbon capture.
So is it basically like research and development seed money?
The bill, what it does is it increases the tax incentive for companies that build this infrastructure, that direct air carbon capture. And there's a whole other bucket of carbon capture that I'm going to get into in a second. But the government rewards companies for sucking air out of the atmosphere. And I think it's $180 per ton now in the bill. So most of these sort of startups had, relied on basically these voluntary offsets. So like a big rich company like Amazon or Google says they want to reduce their carbon footprint or go carbon negative, or they want to support the development of a field that a lot of, folks in the tech community are very, very excited about. The idea, that you can kind of have your cake and eat it too is that we're going to build direct air carbon capture infrastructure and solve this whole problem, bing, bang, boom. It's not actually that simple in the thermodynamics of doing that. Some people say it will never work out. But in any case, there's a lot of money going into that. But the U.S. government's tax incentive to store that carbon dioxide or to bring it out of the atmosphere is going to make it much, much easier to fund these projects, the direct air carbon capture projects. The other big bucket and potentially a more significant one, likely the much more significant one in the near term, is point source carbon capture. So that's polluting facilities around the U.S. Release a lot of CO2. And, we all remember the clean coal talk from a few years ago that sort of died out because the projects didn't work. But there's a potential to be able to basically, burn fossil fuels or release CO2 from cement production or other high emitting activities. And then you take all that CO2, squeeze out all the water vapor and useless gases and nitrogen and whatever, put it in a big pipe it to an oil field or to a saline cavern, and then pump that CO2 underground. So you are able to cancel out the emissions from a high polluting activity. And the government is going to be paying companies a lot more to do that in the new Inflation Reduction Act. So there's going to be a big, basically, spurt of construction activity to try to build pipelines and injection wells and other infrastructure to try to be able to do that and take advantage of those tax credits, which, suddenly make it very, very tempting for companies to try to, reduce their emissions by getting the government to pay them to put their emissions somewhere other than the atmosphere.
So I want to ask you a question about the whole subsidies issue, which this kind of gets into. But I do want to remind our listeners that this is actually a call-in show, and we're just over halfway through. So if you want to get your questions and or comments into my guest, Alejandro de la Garza, journalist, staff writer with Time Magazine, you might want to consider doing it soon. It's 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. It's very interesting, important stuff. We're getting some of the nuts and bolts you don't tend to hear about with the broader reporting on that bill. So what you're basically saying is that these are forms of subsidies, that it's kind of like using the carrot rather than the stick to get these corporations to change their behavior. And obviously it's been a huge struggle and a political tug of war, you know, over the role of the EPA, over, you know, it's back and forth from administration to administration. These policies tend to change, you know, and as you said, the question is interesting as to why the so-called clean coal technology didn't work. Is it because it was just, you know, is there technology available, but it's just the kind of technology that would actually work is too expensive and cuts too much into the profits of those companies? That's what's going on?
Yeah, that's my understanding. So it's one of those things. Carbon capture really depends on who you talk to. If you talk to folks in the environmental justice community, the line tends to be this is a waste of money, and also that it won't work. Basically, they'll argue that the technology has never worked and won't work and is a big scam. And, you know, you can pump the carbon underground, but you don't know if it's going to stay there. If you talk to people who are in the industry, they say, you know, that's a load of crap. The technology works great. It's all ready to go. We just need a bit more money to do it. Or basically, it's too expensive. So that's why they need the federal money. So there's a big issue of, you know, whether when you pump carbon underground into these saline aquifers, whether it will stay there. The indication is it probably will. They've been doing it in the North Sea for a while, and this carbon capture technology was actually developed back in the 70s, not as really a climate mitigation strategy, but by oil companies trying to extract more oil. So when you pump up, when you release natural gas from underground, natural gas has been sort of trapped there under high pressure for a very long time. Sometimes it comes up with a bunch of CO2, and then you can take that CO2 and it actually turns out it's a very good medium. If you stick it, if you pump it back underground again, you can basically squeeze out more oil underground. So that's called enhanced oil recovery. And appears to be that it generally stays there once you put it back. So that's the whole logic is oil companies developed this technology for oil extraction and are now basically, it's their big sales pitch to the climate movement is we're going to do our part and become carbon management companies and use this piece of technology that we developed to help all of you. You're welcome.
And of course, just like the military, global militaries don't want to reduce their operations and their size, what big institution does? And these private corporations, which have been making billions and billions over the decades on finding, extracting, refining, distributing, selling fossil fuels, they don't want to reduce their operations, obviously, so try to come up with these technical fixes, and they want the government to pay for it because they can't cut into their profits because that's the way the capitalist system operates. Anyway, it's a broader question, you know, whether sort of a shifting of subsidies from direct and indirect subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, which encourage them to produce, to subsidies that actually encourage them to do these technologies that can, you know, it's an interesting question. It seems to me kind of like three card Monty, but I don't know. I'm kind of cynical. But we do have two callers all of a sudden, and we do who want to talk with my guest Alejandro de la Garza of Time Magazine, and there's Mitch and Marcus, and Mitch is up first. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks for bringing Mr. Garza on. And I had a question. He's a reporter, so he doesn't often get to express his opinions, but I'm asking for his opinion on whether the Inflation Reduction Act is a misnomer, and how did it come to be called that?
Do you know that, Alejandro?
Yeah, sure. I think my personal opinion is it's a bit of a misnomer. I mean, I think that the budget analysis showed that it would have a deflationary effect as opposed to an inflationary effect. So Senator Manchin, his line in the negotiation and why he pulled out of negotiations was that he said that he thought the revisions in the climate bill and there's some other important stuff there around drug prices, but that it was going to be inflationary, and he didn't want to do anything that was going to cause more inflation for West Virginians. And then some very dogged senators got their staffs and did a lot of analysis and showed that there really wasn't any reason to expect that this was going to have an inflationary aspect, and that it would in fact be deflationary. So they explained it very carefully to Senator Manchin and brought him around and then put that label on it. So it's a deflationary overall. So it's the Inflation Reduction Act. But you know, it's the point of it is not exactly inflation in I think most people's minds. I mean, it's a nice bit of marketing. Basically,
what do the economists say?
I think the general consensus is that it's going to have a deflationary effect overall, but it's putting government funds towards emissions reduction incentives and allowing healthcare price reductions.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, Mitch.
One last thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's this whole technology of sucking carbon back out of the air instead of releasing it into the deep space. Is carbon a renewable resource?
So the issue right now is that there's too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So I think we're supposed to have we're at a pretty high atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide, the highest atmospheric concentration we've had in many millennia. So the issue at this point is that there's too much carbon in the atmosphere because we've been taking it from underground, burning it, and then it goes into the atmosphere and we're increasing this concentration. So
increasing the Earth's temperature.
Yeah, and then the increased concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is causing the atmosphere to retain more heat, which is increasing the average temperature of the planet. So the objective overall is to try to stop emitting carbon into the atmosphere and keep it underground. And then the sell for the direct air capture folks is we can also help that process by reducing the concentration directly as well and putting it underground. So, there's no one, we're really not worried about having too little carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We have way too much.
Do we need it back in the ground, or do we need it released above the atmosphere and out into space?
I don't think that there's a feasible way to get it into space. The energy required to do that, I don't even know how one would begin to do that, but gravity is very strong and takes a lot of energy to put anything into space. So if you try to, pack a bunch of compressed CO2 into a rocket and throw it into space, I'm pretty sure you're going to end up releasing a lot more carbon to actually get enough energy to do that than you would be able to remove.
Okay, we'll get another
Thank you for fielding the questions, and I hope both of you keep asking them.
Okay, thanks for calling, Mitch. And before we go to Marcos, our next caller, I just want to, the graphic for this, my program page on KBOO.fm says, ending direct and indirect subsidies for coal, oil, and gas could amount to $649 billion a year. Cutting unnecessary military spending could provide another $350 billion a year. That would free up almost $1 trillion every year for life-saving priorities like addressing climate change. kind of sums it up. And yeah, well, let's just go to our next caller. Marcos, you're on the air.
Good morning. I sort of feel like I'm witnessing a conversation about which unicorns are better, orange unicorns or purple unicorns. That's my reaction every time I hear the word carbon capture. We have approximately 8 years, probably more like 7 years, according to climate scientists. The consensus is we need to cut our carbon footprint in half by 2030. Practically none of this fancy new technology that would be wonderful if it actually existed will come into fruition within this 7 or 8 years, or will actually be usable within that time. So any talk about how do we preserve the status quo, how do we maintain America as the world hegemon with a military that's something like 10 or 11 times as big as all the other militaries combined that are the next 10 militaries. How do we maintain that and then call it green? How do we maintain a capitalist economy that does nothing but produce homeless people and billionaires and puts everybody else in a precarious, stressful situation? How do we maintain that status quo that's killing us and then call it green?
Okay.
What we actually, if you have to say something, I was just going to say that we really need to be thinking about efficiencies with the known technologies that we already have to eliminate decadent, wasteful spending, which is our norm, and to actually respond to this as if we have an urgent timeline, which again is only 7 or 8 years to actually do the heavy lifting. Most of the ideas that you've been talking about technologically would require quite a bit longer than that, if they're even possible.
Well, let's let Alejandro respond, and you can have a follow-up. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that point, and I most of what you said right there. I mean, I think I agree with wholeheartedly. I mean, the issue of carbon capture is something that I've been focusing on specifically, and is sort of a redirection of some of the energy towards cutting emissions. There are, arguments that, if we can slap carbon capture on some of these emitting facilities, that we'll be able to rapidly draw down their emissions. But it remains to be seen if that will actually work, because this is the first time the government has ever actually has funded it. And there's a lot of great arguments as to why we should really be doing everything possible to eliminate polluting facilities rather than pay them to more money that is, in effect our money, to keep operating with an additional subsidy to, do something with their emissions besides heating the planet with it. I think the point of, the urgent timeline that we have right now and the fact of the enormous amount of emissions cuts that we need to make cannot be understated. And most of that, has to come, almost all of it has to come from reduction of emissions. And that involves some technological switching. There are things that our society needs to operate that need to be changed. And then there's also a big looming question, which I've been very interested in, which is, how much of the current system it can actually ever be sustainable, whether it's the military or, our massive global engine of consumption that I guess the I think homeless people and billionaires is a great way to put it. We put a lot of energy into producing plastic junk, too, that we ship all over the world. And, how much of that is ever going to be sustainable, and what why are we trying to make sustainable some of those activities that don't seem to actually benefit anybody? I mean, these are huge questions, and we're running out of time to answer them.
Indeed.
Well, these responses to climate change that you were going over for the first half hour of the show, they'd be appealing to people that do want to preserve the status quo, and that status quo being the presumption that people live in upper middle class or a middle class American lifestyle, which has been pointed out by environmentalists years ago, that if the world was to adopt that lifestyle that we now take for granted, that we now see as an entitlement, if the world was to experience that lifestyle, the 7 billion plus people that we have on the planet, okay, it would require several more, Paul might know the answer, it would require something like 3 or 4 additional planet Earths worth of resources.
Marcos, we only have a few minutes left and we have another caller. But I appreciate your calling in. And I think the point of talking about the carbon capture and the bill is just, I think people should know about this stuff because these terms are out there, and I don't think that made people really understand them. And then putting them in the context of what you were saying, the realistic timeline, because I totally agree. I think, you know, if you read any of these big policy discussions, even, you know, what's in a lot of these bills, you know, it's like reduce so-and-so by 2050. Blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it shows no real coming to grips with the real timeline that's happening. You know, I think it's very optimistic that, you know, we have 8 or 9 or whatever years, but we won't get into that right now. But thank you for calling, Marcos. And so I just wanted, before we get to our next caller, hold on for just a second. So you do get into, you know, at the end of this article, I think it's important. Again, this is Alejandro de la Garza, staff writer for Time Magazine. The particular article we are focusing on, in addition to a few others, to take climate change seriously, the U.S. military needs to shrink. And this is from February of this year. And I'm scrolling down, excuse me. So military aviation accounts for about 70% of all of the Department of Energy's energy use. Okay, quote, "The only way to reduce fuel use is to reduce how often jets are flying," says Heidi Peltier, director of programs at Brown University's Cost of War Project. That, she says, means the military cannot maintain its globe-spanning presence and become carbon neutral at the same time. A sustainable military will have to be smaller, with fewer bases, fewer troops to feed and clothe, and fewer ships and airplanes ferrying supplies to personnel from Guam to Germany. Very succinct. And that's what I've been trying to say, that, you know, these pie-in-the-sky solutions need to come down to earth really fast, and the federal government, the biggest, as you said earlier in your article, the biggest contributor to climate change under the federal government's purview is its military, and ditto for all across the world. And there never been, to my knowledge, I mean, there's been, you know, arms reduction talks, there have been certain classes of weapons that have been, you know, banned. There's been, you know, there was the chlorofluorocarbons reduction, the Montreal Protocol, which was a very groundbreaking, unprecedented virtually. So yeah, there are precedents for this, but in terms of actually, you know, having the nation states of the world revisit their national security priorities and their emphasis on military spending to solve problems, that in my view is that's the only way we have any chance out of the terrible bind we've put ourselves in. So on that note, have you heard any discussion, you know, within military circles, political circles, of actual talking about reducing the military?
No. So not from the folks I talked to for that article. I talked to a few from sort of the defense think tank arena, former military folks, and a little bit from the U.S. Army as well. They are not going to reduce the U.S. military's presence for climate purposes. I think, you know, the reason why, and I think this maybe got a little bit buried, but I didn't mention, but you know, the military is you know, putting in place these, you know, clean technologies or so-called clean technologies, whatever, that are going to have some emissions reductions, but they're not putting them in place because they're, you know, so necessarily so interested in climate. I mean, maybe they're now somewhat interested in making some reductions, but they're putting them in the place because they think they're going to help them win, and they're going to help them fight better. So the idea of the military doing something that's going to make them fight worse, you know, and not be able to invade any other country around the world at will is, you know, kind of a non-starter if you're in the military or if you're a supporter of the military in Congress, I guess. So, you know, the Congress increased the allocation to the U.S. military this year as they do every year. So the military continues to expand, and for now, the idea of, you know, flying less or you know, having a smaller military is basically a non-starter unless you're in sort of a particular part of the environmental community. And I think and with the war in Ukraine and increased geopolitical tensions resulting from it, it's going to continue to be a non-starter for a while, probably until some rubber meets the road here.
Well, let's go to perhaps our last caller. We got a couple on stack, but we got Harry up next. Go ahead. Try to make your question succinct.
Thank you for taking my call. I want to talk about carbon capture. I was reading some articles that they have pipelines crisscrossing the United States with carbon to be captured or maybe just put into the ground. What I'm worried about is they can also use this as a dump. They can put all other type of chemicals in it because they don't want to use the carbon, so they can put any other type of chemicals just to get rid of it.
Okay, we got a short amount of time, Harry, so let's just let Alejandro see if he has any knowledge about that.
Thanks for the question. I think that I haven't heard anything about using the carbon pipelines for anything besides carbon dioxide. You know, that's the main greenhouse gas component of emissions. I don't think that, you know, I'm not a pipeline expert. I think that we're probably not going to have to worry about them putting anything else in those pipelines. You know, they are permitted, and, you know, there's laws that say when you say that you're going to put something in a pipeline, you know, it's a natural gas pipeline, it's an oil pipeline, it's a gas pipeline, you have to actually put what you say you're going to put in it. And when you're talking about putting gas underground, I mean, I don't think that there's a feasible way to sort of inject chemicals, you know, down there just to sort of get rid of them. I mean, the reason you can inject carbon dioxide underground is because it's a gas with a relatively low or high temperature, rather, in which it liquefies. So when you inject it underground, or compress it, it turns into a liquid, and then you put it underground, and it sort of stays there as a liquid. And the idea is that either it stays there under high pressure as a liquid, or it combines with chemicals in the rock, or basically turns into rock after a couple of years. So that's not the worry. I mean, the worry would be, you know, communities that are getting pushed out of the way to build these pipelines, as is happening in the Midwest. And there's also concerns because carbon dioxide leaks can be actually quite dangerous. There was an incident in Mississippi about 2 years ago, and about a few folks almost died. And some are still experiencing some pretty severe health complications from a carbon dioxide pipeline leak that basically it pushes out the oxygen in an area, so they were you can't, if carbon dioxide leaks from a pipeline near you can't breathe.
So we're about out of time, Alejandro. Sorry to our final callers, we not gonna be able to take you because I just want to so you put the ending is really great. You say the U.S. can choose one of two courses: to completely recast its military mindset for the sake of mission cuts, or else to slot some greener tech into its vast war machine. And they say, in fact, defense budgets are sacrosanct in Congress. The most recent defense authorization bill passed in December legislated forbade the Defense Department from closing even U.S. bases that the Pentagon had deemed to be unnecessary. So I guess that answers the question that we were talking about just a bit ago. So are you going to be continuing to look at this issue, or got anything on your mind that you're working on right now?
Yeah, I mean, I was getting interested basically to see what additional chemical, petrochemical build outs basically being funded by the Inflation Reduction Act we're going to see from these you know, giveaways for carbon capture. So it'll be very I'm planning to look mostly into what ways the oil and petrochemical industry is going to be taking advantage of the subsidies in the Inflation Reduction Act, and what kind of environmental effects, or, you know, potentially negative environmental effects that's going to have both on local communities and, you know, perhaps on the climate. So that's what I'll be looking into, and we'll see where it goes. In terms of the military, I'm keeping my eye on it. This was a really great piece to work on, and I was really proud of it. And we'll see, you know, what moves the U.S. military makes in you know, the second half of the Biden administration.
Okay, well,
and if that, we see any kind of emissions reductions at all.
On that note, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much to my guest, Alejandro de la Garza, staff writer at Time Magazine. I'm Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks, Alejandro.
Slick, you investors in hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you're a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse, and that's how it's done. War after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket.